Hello, my name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to Frank Prattle. This is www.frankprattle.com. You're listening at 89.5 FM here in the Bay Area, KPOO. You're also listening at www.wps1.org, PS1 Contemporary Art Center, a MoMA affiliate. We're here live in the San Francisco Arts Commission Gallery in downtown San Francisco, across the street from City Hall, and I have two very special guests with me today. Gary Sangster, the Executive Director of the Headland Center for the Arts in Marin. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Zephyr. How are you?
Just lovely. And Ken Foster, the Executive Director of Yerba Buena Center for the Arts here in San Francisco downtown. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Zephyr.
Maybe if you guys could just start out with giving a brief introduction of who you are and what it is that you do, and then also maybe giving a website for people listening on the radio that can check out your guys' institutions.
Great, thanks. I'm the executive director of Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in downtown San Francisco. I'd argue with you about whether this, where we are right now, is downtown San Francisco.
Ooh, really?
We think we're downtown. And we're a couple of subway stops away from here. Yerba Buena is a multidisciplinary contemporary arts center, 15 years old. We have two buildings. One is a theater, one has gallery space and another theater in it. We do performing arts, visual arts, film and video, public programs. I've just been there for 4 years. Some of some of the reasons why I came there and why I love this job and love this institution is the multidisciplinary nature of it, I think, is really interesting, and I think we have an opportunity to explore what that means as an institution, more so than a lot of places that are sort of pigeonholed as a art museum or a performing arts center or a film screening room. Since we have all of that, I think we have a great opportunity to explore what that means for those things to collaborate, which I think artists are doing. They're pretty far ahead of institutions on this. So that's really interesting to me. Yerba Buena also has a... cultural diversity is in our DNA, is something that I like to say. It was born out of a particular redevelopment agency project in San Francisco that was addressing a lot of needs of the community. And so there's a lot of expectations from a broad spectrum of the community, and it's great to be part of that and to have that as part of our brief, if you will. And I'm particularly enthusiastic about being in Baghdad by the Bay. I think it's really important. As someone who is not from here, has only been here for 4 years, I hasten to tell people who live in San Francisco that they often forget how the rest of the country looks at San Francisco and what they expect. And the expectation of innovation and new ideas and all of that sort of thing coming out of San Francisco. So that makes it a really great place to be and to work.
Sounds good. Gary, yourself?
I'm Gary Sangster. I'm the executive director of Headland Center for the Arts, and I have been in that position for 2 years. I came to Headlands because it's an extraordinary artist-in-residence program, and it's interdisciplinary, like Yerba Buena. It also has a public outreach component. We have public lectures and conferences and seminars. It's a very special place. I have a long history as an art historian and as a museum director and curator, and I've discovered that this particular organization serves a very different function in the arts, in the entire art spectrum. It's entirely about artist research and artist focus on their work and the creation of new work at their particular pace. And what I've discovered is that our model, which is built on peer-to-peer learning and built on an exchange amongst different disciplines, is really a most profound experience. Artists have said to me that it didn't just change their work being at Headlands, it transformed their life. And that, to me, is an astonishing testimony of how powerful the program is. We've been around for about 25 years. We've been incorporated for almost 21. We were founded by artists when there was a great need for studio space in Marin. We're located in a national park on the Golden Gate National Recreation Area in the Marin Headlands. And we occupy several historic, rustic, old military barracks and buildings. And what you probably don't know about Headlands is that we have a campus altogether of 9 buildings, and looking after those 9 buildings, we have a grand total of 9 staff. So there's no other nonprofit in the country that has that particular ratio. And one of our goals going forward is really to expand our program to have even more public outreach and give contemporary artists from the disciplines that we represent more opportunities to interact with the community.
Sounds good. And it also happens to be incredibly beautiful up there as well.
It's incredibly beautiful. The environment is one of the great draw cards of Headlands Center for the Arts.
Yes. So maybe we can get things started out with kind of addressing one of the major themes of Frank Prattle for this go around, and that is public versus private. And this is a fairly broad question, about as broad as you can get when discussing topics. But one specific concern that I have for institutions today, and both of you guys, this definitely applies to where you work, is that in the wake of an NEA cutting funding, smaller and smaller budgets for arts, California cutting its arts budgets almost altogether, is where and how do you guys procure funding? I mean, does it come mostly from public sources? Does it come from private? What is it like working for a large institution now and really trying to keep it afloat?
I wish I knew the answer to that. I would say, first of all, I've been, like Gary, I've been doing this for a very long time, working as an arts administrator for more than 20 years. And I've seen the rise and fall of government funding, the rise and fall of corporations, corporate funding, corporations will save us, corporations will destroy us, individual funding. We've seen, as you noted, the California Arts Council come and go. So a couple things that I think just serve as guide. One is, this is America and we celebrate the entrepreneurial spirit, and why should we be any different? Nobody else is getting a free lunch, as it were. Why should we? So in a way, I feel like a big part of my job is to assess the external environment and figure out what are the pieces that I'm going to be able to put together in what ways in order to make this endeavor succeed and continue and thrive. And so all of the things that you mentioned and more become sort of part of my portfolio of figuring out how to sustain the organization. And the percentages of any one of them might, over the life of, sort of 10 or 15 years, might vary fairly dramatically. Okay, government funding is going down, private funding is going to have to come up. Private funding is going down, government, corporations, foundations, where am I going to get that? And that my background is in performing arts rather than visual arts. I had, in my previous job, worked at the University of Arizona, where we were funded, 85% of our budget came off ticket sales. So we were lauded for the fact that we were very entrepreneurial and we were selling lots of tickets and we were, making this work and all that. But the fact is, when the economy tanked, our income tanked, So whether I'm 85% on ticket sales or 85% on foundations, I'm at risk if I'm overly dependent on any one source. So what I always try to do is figure out what are the various sources available, and believe me, if something's coming up, I'm gonna go for it and get as much of it as I can and hold on to it, squirrel some away for a rainy day. But I think you just have to be kind of nimble in moving around among a really changing environment. And I tend to not, a lot of people in the arts world, you hear an awful lot of, oh, it's so difficult now, it's so horrible now, it's always been difficult. And for 20 plus years I've been doing it, it's always been difficult to get money. It's just the differences are just in how. It's been my experience.
Sounds good. What do you yourself, Gary?
Well, I agree with Ken. Obviously, there's a wide diversity of revenue streams that you have to build in order to make an arts organization in America sustainable. Obviously, there's individuals, philanthropic individuals, and individuals looking for a short-term return on their membership investment. Then there's foundations, philanthropic foundations, who are interested in community building and sustaining, I think, the intellectual and cultural life of their community. And then there's all kinds of entrepreneurial activities, like selling tickets for whatever you produce, like selling part of your product. For instance, if you work with artists, you might sell some artwork, like using your real estate, your facility, to rent space for special events, like creating certain things, merchandising specifically for sale, perhaps renting certain airwaves in order to sell those. There's all kinds of different ways to generate income, and I think generally there's relatively fixed percentages that get parlayed around of what's appropriate. But one thing I think to remember is that in America, part of the funding models for arts and culture are also built on certain processes of failure. If you think about the way Hollywood funds films, for instance, as an example, for every 30 films they make, there's only two that are financially successful, and then there's another 28 that fold. So if you apply that to the contemporary arts model or contemporary creativity model, is it the case that in America is the model is it required that 28 or say 80% of organizations or individuals fail in order to get those 2% that are highly successful? And that to me is a kind of flawed model. And I'm wondering how the economy in general for arts and culture in a place like San Francisco can be grown effectively so that there's a lot more money for all kinds of organizations and all kinds of creative individuals. I think a really good example is the entrepreneurial activity and kind of drive that art schools are undertaking right now, where they have tremendous incentive to expand and create innovative programs so that they can recruit more students, which is where their primary revenue stream comes from.
Sounds good. And San Francisco definitely has its share of fighting art schools, as it were. But we'll get back to that.
Was that struggling, like fighting, or bickering?
That kind of fighting.
Street fighting, I think, mostly.
Street fighting,
whips,
yeah.
And chains. And so, similar to that question, but kind tying into it, is both of you guys have had extremely knowledgeable in the field of arts. You've both worked in it for a very long time now, and you've both seen a lot of changes.
I'm not that old.
Yeah, right. Wait a minute.
I mean, you know, just a couple days of experience. And maybe you could, you know, tell for our listening audience some of the changes that you've seen art go through as far as what's showing up at ICAs across the country or institutions such as Yerba Buena. And Gary, for yourself, what's coming through Headlands and what's on the way? I don't know who wants to tackle that one first.
I think it's kind of an interesting, I may have a bunch of random thoughts about that. I think it's kind of an interesting moment. My assessment of the, which I hope, I imagine we'll get into sooner rather than later, but my assessment of the commodification of the visual art world and this sort of incredible prices that are being bandied about now for visual artwork. I think that's the next bubble that's going to burst now that we've had .com and housing, you know, art, maybe it already has. But I think artists are, a certain number of artists that we're working with or in touch with are reacting negatively to that commodification. And I think that's leading them to experiment with different forms and frankly, to create objects that can't be bought as a way of, you know, some sort of protest, if you will, against the commodification of the art world. So I think that's pretty interesting. I think that the intertwining in the United States of the intertwining of art and culture and the marketplace is deeply problematic, and I live in it, and I work in it, and I have for a long time, and I'll continue to, and you just have to accept that that's what it is. But I think the marketplace exercises, and not just in the visual arts market, exercises undue influence on what frankly gets seen and what people in America perceive to be their culture. And so it's, you know, to me, it's kind of disturbing's maybe a little too strong, but not doesn't make me happy to see this excessive attention paid to the sort of Britney Spears pop culture stuff. Not against pop culture itself, but the way this is all set up,
or against Britney,
or against Britney, God bless her. But again, sort of the buy and sell part of it. I have a sense, and I don't have anything to prove this except anecdotal evidence, but I have a sense that we've, because of that, the richness of our contemporary culture isn't where it might have been had we had a system that was more supportive of artists. And I think at a certain point, people just kind of give up and move on to something else. And I think then we lose something out of that.
Well, it turns out that I am quite old, and I have seen
Gary, I have seen
quite a lot of changes in the trajectory of the art world, and probably since I began in the field, the biggest change, one of the biggest changes, has been the introduction of a discourse around multicultural issues in the production of art and the production of diverse cultural experiences. When I started out in the field, it was pretty dominated by European and American white men. And obviously, feminism has had a powerful effect on the representation of art and culture and identity in the arts and through the arts. And certainly, multiculturalism has become a key indicator of the way in which we recognize different forms of creativity, because ultimately they can be very different kinds of languages. I would think that would be the biggest and most important change that's taken place. As far as the commodification of the art world goes, I have a slightly different point of view to Ken. I actually believe that art has predominantly, since the beginning of recorded history, has been client-driven. And what I mean by that is that certain creative practices have been developed that fit into a social order or a social structure, and they're underwritten or paid for by whoever the client may be, whether it's the tribe or the community or whether it's the city or whether it's an individual entrepreneur like Lorenzo de' Medici. I think that work is funded in particular ways. And then what's happened in the 20th century has been a radical shift in terms of that underwriting of the creation of individual artworks. And that radical shift is predominantly to do with capitalism, that capitalism has generated so much excess capital, that's what its function is, to generate excess capital, that artists have been able to be their own clients, and they've been able to produce work based on their own access to resources. They've been able to either work or have the money and the time to make work, and then put it into the marketplace and find a client post-production, so to speak. Now, that's an unusual experience in the historical development of the way art's been developed and funded. And artists were, in fact, craftspeople that worked at a very high level, a very spiritual and aesthetic level, in order to produce work that served the client's need. And the client could have been, I mean, my favorite example, and I've used this before, I know some people may have heard this, my favorite example is the pyramids, where the client was the state, and the state was the pharaoh, and the pharaoh used every known capital resource to produce those astonishing works of art, which encapsulated religious, social, cultural, spiritual identity in one particular profound object. So I think we're in a situation now where there's a tremendous, what I call, era of the spectacle, where there are large biennales, there are large art fairs, there are tremendous large-scale blockbuster exhibitions. And I'm not negative about those. I love all those things. They're fantastic experiences. But they are very much related to spectacle, and they're not related to individual, intimate, personal identification with art and cultural experience. And I agree with Ken that artists are very much reacting against that in many ways, and making smaller work, more intimate work, work which is related to the body, work which is related to personal insight and vision. So it's certainly shifted. I mean, there are two things going on. One is the spectacle and the mass commodification of the arts, and the other is the intimate identification between the client and the artist. And I think we are living in that culture. We can't necessarily rail against one against the other. Certainly, I think they're products of the way in which our economy, our cultural economy, and our communities are changing, and it's certainly also influenced by technology. Technology is the other big changing factor in the way art's viewed. For instance, the show we're currently in now, I would say half to three quarters of it has a technological component that's driven including by some kind of machine.
What we're doing right now.
What I'm talking into now.
This is an art piece we're creating right here.
So that's been the other big shift, multiculturalism, feminism, and certainly the development of digital technologies.
And so for both of you...
I lost my track.
No, you did good. You're good. You're in the...
That was great, actually. Yeah. I had never thought about it that way. I really appreciate that. And if I could, I would just... I had just gone this year to Art Basel Miami for the first time. I'd never been before. And I will confess, we were doing this for a variety of reasons, but I was a little reluctant because this is an aspect of the world, of the art world, that I struggle with. And so I thought, oh my gosh, I'm 5 days in Miami amongst all this hoopla.
Glitter.
It's just going to make me crazy and I'll just go into my, totally anti-capitalist thing. I actually had a really good time. I mean, I really had fun, went to a lot of parties, saw a lot of art, saw a lot of great art, I think. But I did, getting back to what you said, Gary, about spectacle, by the time I got finished, I thought, well, the way this thing is set up, that it demands that. I saw like two artists that were doing quiet, intimate, beautiful work. Everything was like a psh. Even the I thought, oh, photography, okay, we'll see some subtlety here. Oh, no. It's giant, it's big, it's colorful, it pops off the wall at you. And I just found myself actually just observing that as a cultural phenomenon as opposed to railing against it. I was just like, well, this is really interesting, the way this is going, the way this is happening, and the phenomenon, frankly, of going into that massive exhibition hall as one of the VIPs, where there were only a few thousand people there, and then having the doors open and like tens of thousands of people swarm into this convention hall. So many people you can hardly move. I thought, well, this is something. I'm not sure what this is, but this is something. It's quite a phenom, and I was really just kind of fascinated by that. And your concept of spectacle, I think, really, accurately states kind of what's going on there.
So kind of in the wake of that, I would ask both of you, you're in the positions where you can shape major institutions and really create different kind of... I would say, positions on art that, future, not only artists, but, collectors and, critics, people like that, look at and they say, Yerba Buena is doing this. This is the shape of art now in the Bay Area, or the Headlands is doing this. This is what's going on. So with that knowledge about, biennales and art fairs and large symposiums and things like that, very much the spectacle, What are your responses to that? Has Basel changed your opinion of what Yerba Buena is going to be doing? And Gary, I know that you sent someone down to Basel to be there to check in what's going on. Is Headlands picking somebody up from there?
Well, Headlands is very interested in maintaining knowledge about current developments in the arts. And obviously, visiting New York or L.A. or London or Venice or... Art Basel in Miami or Art Basel in Basel, Switzerland, is a really, really shorthand way of checking in with a huge number of different producers. And I think the nature of that is not just artists, but also dealers and curators and collectors. It's in a sense, it's a community, and it's a community that's expanding. So an art fair or an art biennale like that is a way to conference. It's a way to network. It's a way to find out where things are going. You may not be entirely comfortable with where things are going, but nonetheless, that's where things are going. And Headlands is certainly wants to be up to date as far as that goes. So certainly we had a representative there looking at what was going on, looking at the shape of things, as you call it, which I think is a good way to term it, and the shape is always morphing. It's morphing into one kind of influence, morphing from one kind of influence after another, and it's developing, evolving, and the art world is almost exponentially growing as well. There is a lot of money still pouring into the art world, and I do wonder if there will be a bubble effect too, but there is indicators that the art world is on a very strong and long-term rise in terms of investment in individual artworks. And one can only, I think, see that those institutions, the institution of the spectacle, are expanding.
And it's an interesting question that I actually think about a lot, because I think I certainly believe that the work that we do at Yerba Buena is really vital on a lot of different levels. But whether or not we're an influencer in the art world per se, I don't know. And you know, there's a lot that we're reading and learning about the curatorial eye. That's capital I, not EYE. The way that people want to curate their own experience and the dethroning of institutions of any sort as experts, the Wikipedia effect. There's no expert anymore. Everybody's an expert. We put everything in there and out of that comes truth, as opposed to turning to a source that we credit and is credible and is... So I don't necessarily see Yerba Buena in that position, but rather as the sort of arbiter of taste, but more as a participant in this kind of chaotic environment. And so then what I view as our role, particularly in relationship to spectacle in the art world, or the art fairs, and given the size of institution we are, is to consistently provide an alternative voice, to consistently provide an avenue for artists who might not necessarily be at Art Basel. So I actually... Last summer, went to Documenta, which I found to be much more invigorating and much more challenging and much more thought-provoking and much more helpful to me as the director of YBCA than going to Art Basel, which I felt a little bit like I'm not like the inferior cousin or anything, but I felt a little bit like this is not a world I am part of or necessarily want to be part of, except in the largest sense.
I think too, I would add to that the intellectual rigor of a curated show versus the speculative throwing out of an enormous range of participants that an art fair is obviously. They're very different experiences, and one is absolutely geared towards entertainment, and a show like Documenta or Venice is geared much more towards, I think, intellectual rigor and the relationship specifically to art history as opposed to the art market per se. What I also didn't say is that Headlands is the whole game of spectacle, which has emerged in the marketplace, reinforces the need for Headland's mission, which is to provide artists with time and space to undertake, I think, very profound and deep research into the nature of their innovation and the nature of creativity in their work, which may or may not have an outcome and may or may not enter the realm of spectacle or the realm of distribution, because they may not produce anything based on that particular experience. And we don't require that. So it actually reinforces the kind of need for of the focus mission that we do have around creativity and innovation.
It sounds good. And Headlands, though, does have fairly spectacular people come there as well, though. I mean, your Zach Smiths, your Jim Drains, and these are, you know, international stars making very, you know, very spectacle-oriented work, you know.
Well, one of the beauties of our program is that we have a jury system, and it's not strictly how one would describe as curated. So if people do apply and they're reviewed by a jury of their peers in a variety of fields, and they're selected, and the community is built around that kind of dynamic. So we're not fixed in a sense to one particular view or one or two people's particular views of where things are going, but our strategy is really to keep it very, very open. So we can have very famous people, we can have emerging artists, we can have people who collaborate, we can have solo artists, we can have people who are very young and recent graduates, and we can have people right at the peak of their career. And even senior figures who are looking. One of the criteria, though, that I will say is that we're looking for people who are open to transitional moments or transitional influences in their work. We're not necessarily always looking for people who would just want to do more of the same.
Sounds good.
I want to just add on to that. Lest I am creating the impression that we're somehow some sanctified place, that, you know, we too you know, every now and then, listen, if I can get a great artist who's going in a different direction, doing something different, but they're like making masses of money in the market, I'm not going to, you know, be too good to do that by any stretch. I would welcome that. But like Gary, I mean, that's really a large part of what we're interested in, is whether you're a so-called emerging artist or an art star, what do you want to do here that's going to take you someplace that you couldn't be able to do without us? And so by being with us, will you be able to explore, try something new, go in a different direction, redo something that you were unhappy with? Or that, you know, spirit of creativity is really interesting to us as well.
I think too, one of the important parallels between our two organizations is that we're multidisciplinary. And I think from my perspective, that reflects how the world is. The idea that an art museum will just do fine art or an opera house will just do opera, that it serves a function. It's an absolutely great function. However, the diversity of thinking that artists and creative people are involved in really is about all kinds of disciplines, and sometimes not just artistic disciplines, sometimes science and sociology and geology and geography as well. And so I think a recognition of that kind of those multiple experiences in the world within our institutional framework mm-hmm. is absolutely critical to the success of our organizations.
Sounds good. Just a quick break for station identification. My name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to Frank Prattle. This is KPOO 89.5 FM. You're listening in the Bay Area, or you're listening at www.wps1.org. PS1 Contemporary Art Center in New York, MoMA affiliate, Art Radio. You're also listening at www.frankprattle.com. And my special guests today here at the San Francisco Arts Commission Gallery are Gary Sangster, the Executive Director of Headland Center for the Arts in Marin, and Ken Foster, the Executive Director of Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. So to get back to what we were just talking about a moment ago, as far as the direction things are going for, you know, both of your institutions. One question that I had is how much influence do you think that each of your places of work holds on the private gallery market? I mean, when Headlands is showing someone that, you know, has been, you know, perhaps a marginal figure, and then someone in New York says, well, you know, hey, I just heard that they got a Marin Headlands residency for, you know, 6 months or something like that. How do you think that comes to bear on the private market? And same with Yerba Buena, you know, when they get a star show, you know, what happens then? How much does that color your choices?
Well, I think the complexity of career building doesn't rely on any one institution exclusively. I think there are certain key drivers in the art market which do have profound impact. And let's say that one of them is MoMA in New York, as a good example. Another might be the biggest dealer in the country, whoever that might be. Let's say it's Marion Goodman in New York City as an old school kind of major player. And those two institutions, one a contemporary dealer and one the major modern art museum in the world, will have a profound impact on someone's career. An organization like Headlands, I think, does not have that profound impact. It has a different kind of impact. It's certainly a respected institution, and one knows that if you've been invited to do a residency at Headlands, that you have achieved a certain stature within your field amongst your peers, and that augurs well for your future as a, let's say, an investment quality artist or a museum quality artist or a published novelist or poet. And all of that's good. But it requires many more layers, I think, of career building and, I think, commitment on the part of the artist in order to make that leap, whether they're already established or whether they're just emerging. So I wouldn't say that, I couldn't possibly say that Headlands was a king or queen maker, even though we might aspire to such a role. But I think it's much more complicated with smaller organizations, and it becomes much more of a network of different institutions working together.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that, and I think we're in very much the same place. And I think it's even, it's never our objective to say, we're going to do this show because we're going to make your career with this show. We don't even think about it. We're thrilled when we see that an artist that we presented their work when they were still emerging, and now they have a show at MoMA or they have a show someplace. We're thrilled to that, and we're delighted that it's in their bio that they did Yerba Buena, and we like to think that maybe that helped that trajectory in some way. But our, like Hedlund's, our raison d'etre is really about, certainly about our community and also about the artists themselves. And so if this is an, if what we do by doing a show with you can make some positive impact in your career, that's great. I haven't had this experience necessarily with visual artists, but I have had the experience, the reverse experience in with performing artists that we put, that we got behind, who were frankly not really ready for the spotlight that happens with a Yerba Buena show. They had been working at a certain level. This is a step up, if you will. And they weren't quite, and it was a setback for them. So I'm very sensitive to that, increasingly sensitive to that, in terms of really wanting to suss out with the artist, is this the right show, the right place, the right time for you? That's going to be a net positive for you. And sometimes, you know, artists, you know, frequently don't want to be told, well, what do you mean I'm not ready for a Yerba Buena show? What the heck is that? Like, are you so wonderful? And I'm, you know, I mean, it just kind of goes down that. So a way of having that conversation that says, you know, from our perspective, let's talk about a year from now or 2 years from now. Let's let that piece develop and see what it looks like. And then let's talk about a possible Yerba Buena piece, as opposed to serving as a king or queen maker to their detriment as much as to their, you know, occasionally to their benefit.
Well, kind of dovetailing into that, you know, Ken, it sounds like you definitely have some curatorial experience as far as not just being an executive director. And maybe, Gary, both of you can share how much curatorial actual practice that you guys do at each of your institutions. Are you just the executive director, or is there something
God,
else
no,
at play?
I would just kill myself if that was the job, to be honest with you. I'm a little bit, I would not say that my role and my position is common, but then my institution is not common either. There's, you know, this sort of multidisciplinary presenting the performing arts, visual arts, film and video, you know, regular formalized programs in each of those areas, as well as collaborative projects, and in a lot of cases, there's a kind of a artistic director, managing director model. There's a executive director, chief curator model. Because of the way, the kind of institution we are and the way we work, I serve in the more of the artistic director role in terms of leading the curatorial team. I actually, when I came here 4 years ago, it's a long, complicated story I won't go into, but essentially I was the performing arts curator at that, and took that on as part of the job for a variety of reasons. I now have an associate curator who's very strong, and we still work very collaboratively, but she's really driving the program much more than I was, than in the way that I was doing 4 years ago. So a lot of my curatorial work is really about curating the curators as much as anything else.
Sounds good. Gary?
Our public programs are not quite developed in that way, so I think we have a much less curatorial responsibility. And so I'm really involved in primarily in setting goals in terms of standards, quality, vision, and working with our program director, Anu Vikram, on developing public programs which articulate some of the issues that the artists coming through are dealing with. Occasionally, I will have the opportunity to select or invite a particular artist for a particular reason and include them in a program. But generally, I don't have much of a curatorial responsibility. Most of my curatorial work, which is intermittent now, takes place outside of the realm of Hedlund's because we don't really have a gallery space or anything like that.
Sounds good. And as far as for those listening outside San Francisco who might not be familiar with it, I think that both of you are in a unique position to really kind of give a snapshot of what's going on here. What you know, you both travel extensively and have been all over the world and have seen art all over the place. What seems to be the flavor of San Francisco, if you could sum it up briefly? Both of you guys, they're pointing at each other right now. I know it's a difficult one.
Oh, gosh, I feel completely unqualified to answer that question.
But if not you, then who?
Yeah, that's a good question, isn't it? I could talk about that in terms of the performing arts in a much more thoughtful way. And again, you know, vis-a-vis what Gary was just saying about what our roles are, is that there's a certain remove, and I won't pretend to have my finger on the pulse of the San Francisco visual arts world. I have staff people for whom that's their job, right, and they would answer that question much better than I do as well. And the only reason I could say anything about that in terms of the performing arts is because of my, you know, my work there over the last few years since I've been here and knowledge of this area since. I would say, in general, I don't think we're as progressive as we like to think we are.
Dead silence.
I'll just leave that there.
Gary, what do you think about that?
I think no one's ever as progressive as they
think
they are.
That's probably true.
They always think they're much more kind of adventurous. I've been here for 2 years, and I'm concerned primarily about the nature of this, what I'd describe as a kind of underdeveloped arts economy. I think there is a tremendous history of West Coast creativity and conceptual activity. I only have to think about someone like David Ireland, who did the major installation at Headland Center for the Arts, and consider how important he is, not just in San Francisco, but internationally, and yet how under-recognized he is internationally, one might say. To think that there is a very significant history of West Coast arts production. Secondly, I think there's a very significant history of alternative spaces and experimental galleries. I think there's also been tremendous cultural drift because the arts economy has been so weak, ultimately, and I think that commercial dealers who are vital to a growing arts economy struggle a great deal to find appropriate support within the collecting community or within the philanthropic community. I think that there's a wonderful opportunity now that SF MoMA has been around for a decade or so and is really, I think, finding its legs as far as developing spectacle-style shows and serious art historical shows. I think there's tremendous excitement around the Renaissance, what I describe as the Renaissance of the art schools, and the tremendous drive to recruit young and creative people into San Francisco. What's required is a growth of the economy to support those people once they graduate. So I think there is an issue around how much cultural money stays in the Bay Area and how that supports younger artists and younger art dealers in terms of developing the arts economy. I think it's absolutely, I mean, in some senses, the success of an organization like Headlands is one could almost say antithetical to the arts economy, because we support a large number of artists, but only for a very brief time. And even though we have tremendous value in the community, what we really need is 100% support for a wide range of artists going over decades, not just going over 3 months or 6 months. And that's I think, a big challenge. So San Francisco, I think, has always, in some senses, competed with the other big cities like L.A. and Chicago and certainly, in some senses, New York. But there really needs to be some emphasis on how we keep the economy very vibrant in terms of supporting the arts. I think it's very difficult to balance the budget, certainly for non-profit organizations like us, but I think it's even more difficult for independent artists to pay the rent and work at the level that they're expected to be successful locally, nationally, or internationally.
Sounds good. It's definitely a conundrum there. I think no one argues about that one. Money is always tight across the globe. Maybe we can open it up if anybody has any questions from the audience that they've been dying to talk about.
Well, you started to
hold on just half a second. Let me give the mic over to you.
I suppose, Ken, you were saying that we're not as progressive as we think we are, and then you very politely stopped. And I would ask, not meaning to put you on the spot, but it would be informative to know in what ways we aren't as progressive as we think we are.
You know, my experience about that is it's a very, you know, it's a 7x7 geographical area. It's 750,000 people in that area, San Francisco, which is, I came here from Tucson, Arizona, which has the exact same population, 750,000 people. So sort of socioculturally, I felt right away the scope of the place that I was at, right? You know, in the sense that, oh, you run into people that you know and you see all the time and, you know, like it's manageable. It's not Los Angeles, where you would feel like, oh my God, it's just so enormous, I couldn't possibly, you know, and everything gets really, really balkanized and smaller in sense of that. So it's a very close-knit, it's a very tight community. We really celebrate our progressiveness, and we talk to each other a lot. And so what I found is that the conversation and the cultural discourse, if you will, kept returning in and returning in and returning in, and I kept finding old conversations that I'd heard from 10 years ago were being replayed over and over and over again. And then when I started to see work, I started to see those old conversations reenacted in the work. And I thought, I'm really like to think about San Francisco as a Pacific Rim city that has a vision that connects with Asia, Latin America, even Africa, in a much more dynamic way than it does. But because of the way we keep turning into each other, I feel like we aren't as connected out and therefore influenced by those kinds of things that are happening in other parts of the world that I consider to be our neighbors, like, you know, China, India, Japan, certainly all of Latin America. I mean, I don't feel that engagement with those. And to me, and I guess that's what I mean by progressive, but then, and the reason for the sort of smart-ass comment is that, you know, is that we have a tendency to pat ourselves on the back. Well, we're San Francisco, we're hip, we're cool, but I actually have to leave this city to see stuff that rocks my world in a way that I don't see in this city.
Sounds good. Maybe if you could come up to the front.
Hi, my name's Tressa, and I'm involved quite a bit in that internal dialogue since I'm faculty both at the CCA and the San Francisco Art Institute.
Earlier, you're deep in it.
Opened up with some street fighting anecdotes. But to jump into your point, I wonder, there's a lot of talk, and since prior to both of you coming to the Bay Area as well, is San Francisco having situated itself as a kind of workshop town. And working with students who will soon be entering that market, as you will, I'm wondering how you see the relationship between what you just said as kind of a closed-circuited discourse of the locality and the grander kind of spectacle and visual cultural events of the international and global art scenes like Documenta and the Biennales, the relationship.
Yeah, that's good. Let me just say one quick thing about that. I think it's a mistake I'm not saying this is what you were implying, but I think it's a mistake to assume that being a citizen of the world means buying into a spectacle of international biennials. Some of the most extraordinary work that I've seen is really on the ground in places like Asia and Africa by artists who are in much the same, or frankly, much worse financial straits than what you find in this city or almost any place in this country where this work is being produced. And that work, to me, is vital in the way that it connects out to the rest of the world. So what I'm saying is that it isn't necessarily that, oh, because I'm in trying to be connected internationally or participate in the international discourse, I can only do that by going to the Venice Biennale. Those societies and those worlds are much more complex than that, and I want to connect with people who are wrestling with really intense issues that seem to just sort of be passing us by. I'm not sure that makes sense, but
I would just add that I agree with Ken in many ways. I think that the issue of what constitutes progressiveness is to try and identify what is genuinely innovative or constitutes actual change. And if we go through many of the institutional behaviors in San Francisco, what is the most profound kind of sense of innovation that we have? And I don't know all the institutions that well, so I can't really answer the question, but there's one that I do know that seems to me to be profoundly leading, and that's the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, which has policies and programs, albeit kind of quaint in some ways because of who they are and what they are, but they're actually developing the park system in leading ways across the nation. And that kind of innovation just doesn't seem to be happening in our cultural sector as strongly. I mean, it's very nice that we have a brand new de Young Museum. It's very nice that we have, you know, a lovely new SF MoMA. But in some senses, these are kind of mimicking other cultural institutions around the world. And it seems to me that what we ought to be looking for in terms of progressiveness, because I'm endorse progressiveness, is what constitutes genuine change, both in the broader culture, in terms of individual transformation and understanding, and in terms of community institutions. How are our institutions changing? We haven't developed our better healthcare in San Francisco yet. We have, down the road, we have Google developing better search engines, but, you know, we all use that around the world. What other changes are happening that make San Francisco a genuinely cultural progressive city?
A tough question.
I think you're absolutely right, and let me be clear that I don't necessarily put my own institution that's something that we struggle with constantly, the weight of institutionality when you have two giant buildings and you have to pay the heat and the lights and blah, blah, blah. And there is, as you say, there's a sort of cultural weight on you that says, well, you should be something X, which everybody knows and identifies and recognizes because that's what institutions are, and you're trying to, like, fight against that, and yet that weight is definitely there. So I think for us internally, that's something that we struggle with all the time, and as much as I and my curators and my staff try to sort of push forward and break boundaries, there's like 42 people behind us explaining all the good reasons why you can't do that or shouldn't do that or why that won't happen, and sometimes that wins.
And they're not being negative, they're being positive.
They're trying
to help you by telling
exactly,
you why it can't
exactly,
happen.
Exactly. I mean, we've had this conversation about excellence, you know, and staff people saying to me, but we're all about excellence. And so we have a big conversation about what exactly do you mean by that?
I think that's a perfect note to leave it on. Unfortunately, we're out of time. My name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to Frank Prattle. You're listening at 89.5 FM KPOO, live here in San Francisco, or somewhat live. And you're also listening at www.wps1.org, Art Radio, PS1 Contemporary Art Center in New York, a MoMA affiliate. You're also listening at www.frankprattle.com and San Francisco Arts Commission Gallery website, possibly as well, at www.sfacgallery.com. Yeah, that was impressive. I spelled it all. My special guests today are Gary Sangster, the executive director of the Headland Center for the Arts up in Marin.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. You're fantastic. And Ken Foster, the executive director of Yerba Buena Center for the Arts here in downtown San Francisco. Thank you, guys.
Great. Thanks, Jeffrey.
Bye-bye.